Hashtag you don't have to be Jewish.
Joining us on the line is Peter Fabricius, who is a foreign affairs journalist. He's written extensively on this and certainly is way more knowledgeable than I am. A very good morning to you. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm fine.
You wrote a very interesting article. And as I said in the intro, I'm deeply skeptical around this vaccine nationalism, just because I think it's a fantastic excuse for anyone looking for one. That said, it doesn't make it not real. Give us your sense.
Yeah, look, It is a difficult concept. I'll agree with you. What everyone has in mind here is that there was a huge amount of HIV treatment nationalism back in the 90s, and Africa had to wait a very long time. It's been much better this time, but there's still traces of it. And of course, in every case, you have to see that there's another side to the story. So right now, the real culprit, if you like, of vaccine nationalism in Africa's eyes is India, because India is depending quite heavily on India to supply something like 600 to 700 million doses of AstraZeneca to make up their shortfall. They've got a lot of about 400 million J&J in line in the pipeline, but they need these others. And of course, India has just stopped exporting AstraZeneca because it's had this massive surge. So, you know, what do you do if you're an Indian government? I guess you're facing a real crisis. I mean, they've got extraordinary numbers of people being infected and dying. Then you've got to put your national interests first. You know?
And to some extent, isn't that the way it should work? That shouldn't every government do everything that they can for the people of their country?
Yeah, no, that is true. But, you know, I guess you always have the problem in Africa that, but not all. Are you hearing me okay?
Yes, absolutely perfect.
Yeah, where you don't have the capacity, the resources and so on
of course,
completely fill the need. And not so in South Africa, obviously, and other countries like Morocco and so on, which can afford their own. And South Africa, as we know, is manufacturing J&J through Aspen.
Right.
And is going to be supplying the rest of the continent, actually. So I don't think we have an issue. You know, we have other issues with the vaccine, but not supply issues.
The COVAX system, is that playing out well? Has that been a success?
Yeah, I think COVAX is a good initiative. COVAX, though, has fallen prey to the same issue. I mean, there's a shortfall for the African Union of 300 to 350 million people to get a vaccine, but double the number of doses because that's a two-dose treatment.
Mm.
They were getting through AstraZeneca, so they've fallen part of that as well. But I think COVAX will eventually kind of deliver what it's, and maybe not as much and as quickly.
Right.
But I think it's been quite a successful initiative. Look, it's never going to be enough, but because there has been this problem of the wealthier countries, of course, buying up more than they need just in case, and buying, you know, overbuying just in case one doesn't produce. You know their story.
Absolutely.
Their view, though, is that they put a lot of money into that, a lot of state money, because the state has backed up a lot of those manufacturers. In Britain, for example, AstraZeneca. So that it's not like they just hoarding
right,
for nothing.
Right.
You know, this is the result of an investment policy,
which will ultimately benefit everybody else because they have put in that investment
and benefit others. Actually,
right,
yeah.
Right. And the other side of that, I guess, is that then it flips quite quickly. If countries have hoarded or if countries have bought too much, the minute they see that they have this oversupply, suddenly other stocks might become available.
Countries like Britain have promised to make available their surplus, you know, where as you say, as soon as it becomes apparent that they have got them from elsewhere. So hopefully there's quite a lot of dependency on that. I don't think that's been calculated, factored into the calculations of the African Union, for example, but one would hope that that is going to be a bit of a lifesaver down the line.
I would think so, but obviously only time will tell. The other concern, of course, is that we don't really know, maybe aside from South Africa and one or two other places, we don't really know what the impact of COVID-19 has been as a result of poor testing systems and mechanisms.
It's been controversial through the whole year and more of COVID about what is going on in Africa. And a lot of people felt like you say, that the lack of testing meant that we didn't really know the picture. And there's even in many countries a lack of capacity to really calculate the number of dying and dead. The sense has been that it hasn't hit Africa quite as hard as expected, given it's relatively inadequate health services, on average. Nobody's quite figured out why the youth population is affected. There are others as well. But I think there's a sense that we would know if there's been like a massive...
I also do believe that. I really do. Because no matter how we're testing, if you look at what is happening in India, where they are officially having around about 250,000 new cases every day, hospitals are overwhelmed, people are dying, they can't get in, they can't get any care. We would see it. It would be there.
We're seeing it in India, India and Africa are in some ways in the same category, because people are wondering, why on earth is India not being hit by a mass, because it's a huge population, very close quarters. Now it seems to be happening.
So how do we use the term vaccine nationalism with some measure? I guess that's really what I'm trying to figure out, because it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It of course exists. We see it.
Yeah.
We can see the wealthier countries, as you say, hoarding vaccines, pushing very hard. There might be justification, as you're saying, because they might have put money into it. They've been more reactive, etc. But but it does exist. How do we balance this understanding of it?
You know, ideally, and this is really ideally, because it would only occur in an ideal world where you had a global approach to this, that you would have a pooling of all the vaccines, and you would say, we will now distribute these according to need. So in other words, in the poor countries in Africa and so on, older people who are the most vulnerable and people with morbidities, et cetera, would get them before younger people in the rich world. But that isn't what's happening. So what's happening, obviously, is that the rich countries are saying, sorry, we're going to vaccinate all our people first, and then, if we've got any leftover good stuff, we'll give them to you and your older people, and sick people can... But, that requires, as I said, a global consciousness about this thing and a global approach, which we just don't have.
Absolutely.
The World Health Organization would have been the locus for that kind of thing to happen, but it... Apart from the fact that its credibility was, I think, rather
damaged,
unfairly undermined by they made mistakes, but not to the extent that the Trump administration would have had. But that would have been where it should have happened from. But it just doesn't have that kind of power. It's not granted that kind of power.
100%. Unfortunately, that is where we do need to leave it. Peter Fabricius, foreign affairs journalist, talking to us about why Africa is struggling to meet its vaccine targets. Thank you for a very, very interesting conversation.